Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Sumullah here. So now we're proceeding with the final training. And if you're just joining us in the last couple of days, I'd like to welcome you. And then I'd also like to strongly encourage you to read the report and watch the previous pieces before moving forward with today's presentation. And this is going to be a lengthy one. And to say that we have a lot of ground to cover is an understatement. Okay, we have a mammoth task on our hands today. Okay, this is material that would normally spread over 8 hours. And I'm attempting to teach it in a single 60-minute presentation. Okay, I think what's made this manageable and somewhat possible is the report that preceded, and also the earlier two pieces. It did a lot of the heavy lifting. So today we can move forward with the sentence and develop the possible usages for the ism, the total amount of ways that the ism could be used in the sentence. So let's proceed. Okay, so in the previous video we spoke about the four stages of growth. And that our aim and our goal in these 10 days that we have together is to get you out of the startup stage and get you into initial growth. So what that means is that we want to give you the 4% of the language that will give you over half of all of your benefits. And this is by understanding the mistake that in order to master classical Arabic and to learn classical Arabic so that you can understand the Quran and appreciate its miracle, you can't begin with the simple. You have to acknowledge that the Arabic language is an intricate system for the conveyance of meaning, and it has a word level and it has a sentence level. The majority of meanings in Arabic do not come from the words, but instead they come from the vowels and the patterns and the grammatical structures. And this was highlighted with the istan saru example in the previous video. Okay, we did it in the report, and then I redid it again in the previous video just to show you that it doesn't have to be in the exact same way that was given in the report. You don't have to parrot my words, but what you need is a mini presentation. You need a 5-minute presentation where you can do that. You can take the structure, istan saru, and you can break it down, and you can explain the translation as they sought help, and the actual total number of meanings from there are 7. Okay, so what looks like a single word is giving you 7 meanings. Only one of those 7 meanings is coming from the dictionary, the rest are not coming from the dictionary. So this seamlessly leads into the introduction of sarf. It introduces the science of sarf, and you have the components in order to define it and to give a proper understanding of what that science is. And we do the same for grammar, and we did it in the previous video. We mapped the language, we talked about the most basic sound that comes out of the human mouth and how it divides into the meaningful and the meaningless, and then ultimately that led to words, sentences, and phrases. And then from there we spoke a bit about subclassifying. We subclassified the word and the phrase, and we got to the sentence, and we're going to proceed now from there. And we spoke about grammatical states in the previous presentation. We spoke about grammatical states, and we introduced them, we peeled the first layer, and we gave you their names, which were Rafa, Nasab, and Jar, and we likened them to human emotions and facial expressions. Okay, Arabic words were likened to human emotions and facial expressions, and we didn't stop there, but then we introduced a second analogy, which was the English pronouns he, him, and his. So we lined up the Rafa with the he, the Nasab with the him, and the Jar with the his. So if you understand in English the difference between he, him, and his, you have a 60-70% understanding of what Rafa, Nasab, and Jar are automatically, immediately. Okay, so that's what we did in the previous video. So we're going to move forward now, and we're going to redevelop that, the grammatical states, the Rafa, the Nasab, and Jar, and tell you exactly what Rafa is. Because up until now, you're thinking that Rafa means subject. And up until now, you're thinking that Nasab means object, and you're thinking that Jar means possessive. So that was not entirely accurate. Okay, but we did that on purpose in order to create the mental imprint, because our intention is to come back to the discussion, as we're going to do now. Okay, so I got that out of the way. Okay, so now I'm going to slow down a little. Okay, the reason I was speaking a little more quicker, because this presentation is going to get lengthy, and that's not something I can help. Okay, so let me just remind you again that all of these videos are downloadable, and they all have transcripts. The previous transcript, my assistant, Sister Rahima, sat until 4:25 a.m., creating that transcript in order to get it to your hands. So we're going to do the same with this video. We're going to create a transcript for it. So with the help of that transcript, inshallah, if you watch it a couple of times, then you will get it. You will understand the overall big picture, and you'll get the core concept. Okay, so let's press forward with this. Okay, so we're speaking about the sentence. But first of all, let's remind you of the purpose of grammar. So grammar is this process of how the words experience grammatical states and how the states are reflected on the last letter. That's what it is really, what we introduce grammatical states. Now, knowing this is important, it's not only important in order to protect you from verbal error in the sense that you speak correctly and what you say is valid, which is important, right? Because it will be awkward if you're making mistakes. But not only that, but it's actually integral to communicating. Without it, communication ceases to exist. You will not be able to do something as fundamental as distinguishing between which of the nouns is the one doing the verb and which of the nouns is the one upon whom the verb is being done. Your listener will be totally confused if you get the grammar wrong. Okay? So it's to protect yourself and your audience from confusion. Ibn Khaldun, he lists the four sciences that make up classical Arabic, the four areas, and the first one is mufradat, which is vocabulary, and this is an area that needs to be studied, and I sort of bypass it, or I sort of downplay it in the report and also in the previous video, but I'm not trying to say that it's not important. It is important, but it's something that will build gradually, and the best way to build vocabulary is not through flashcards or through vocabulary lists, but through an actual reading text. So since our aim is to begin the reading text so early on, so that's why we can focus right now on the non-word meanings. Okay? So this is why the emphasis right now is not on vocabulary. The emphasis right now is on the second area, which is grammar. And when he says grammar, he means inclusive of sarf. Because classically, this is what the scholars did. They would write a single manual that gave you the principles of grammar and also had a section on the principles of sarf. Okay, so that's the second. And the third one's rhetoric. And rhetoric is when you have all this flexibility, the question is what do you do with it? Okay, so if you have a verb and two nouns that can be formatted in six different ways, so which one to use at what time? So one of them is the standard format, and the other five are the unconventional arrangements of the words. So when to resort to those unconventional methods, this is taught to you in rhetoric. And from these four areas, the fourth one is literature. And literature means studying the works of the scholars and reading the the elevated prose of the scholars and the fiction writers also, the fiction writers, the poets. So to read their works and see how they use metaphor and how they use metonymy and how they structure their sentences and how they communicate their meanings. So theory alone will not help you, but along with the theory you have to have a considerable amount of reading, so it needs to become 50-50, which incidentally is what we do in our program, that when we're teaching grammar and morphology, we're spending half of our time on reading. Okay, so from these four areas, the most noble and the most exalted is the rhetoric area. And Al-Qazwini, who is the author of Talkhis al-Miftah, which is the standard book in Balagha, the Matan, the manual in Balagha, which At-Taftazani wrote the commentary on in 550 pages, he says that Ajallul ulumi qadran, the science of Balagha, the sciences of Balagha, it has three sub-sciences, so this rhetoric is the most exalted of the sciences associated to the Arabic language. And the reason he says that is because through Balagha, إذ به يكشف عن وجوه الإعجاز في نظم القرآن أسرارها. Because through Balagha, in the veils are removed. Through Balagha, the veils are removed from the faces of miraculousness within the words of the Quran. I'll say that one more time. Through the sciences of Balagha, the veils are removed from the faces of miraculousness in the words of the Quran. Okay, so when you know this, then you can see the miracle in front of you. And I spoke about this in the first piece also, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala himself says, أَفَمَنْ كَانَ عَلَى بَيِّنَةٍ مِّن رَبِّهِ. Can the rejecter of the Qur'an be equal to the one who is upon evidence from his Lord, and to it is attached its own internal witness? So it's the special use of the language within the Qur'an that makes it miraculousness. So when you know this, this strengthens your faith. And this strengthens your conviction and your belief in the Qur'an being the words of Allah. So the Qur'an actually begins speaking to you. So this is the most noble of the sciences. Okay, but it's not the most important. Okay, I'll say that one more time. It's not the most important. The most important is grammar. Because without grammar, communication ceases to exist. There's a degree of grammar that needs to be provided up front. Without it, you can't begin any reading. And you can't understand any, even a children's book. You wouldn't be able to understand a children's book, let alone the words of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Ibn Khaldun, he says, أَهَمُّهَا النَّحْوُ. The most important of them is grammar. إِذْ لَوْلَاهُ. Because without grammar, لَجُهِلَ أَصْلُ التَّفَاهُمْ. Communication ceases to exist. The very core of tafahum. Tafahum means communication. The very core of communication will become unknown. Okay, so this is what we're doing in this presentation, this is what we did in the previous presentation, and this is what we introduced to you in the report. These are the most important things in the language, period. Okay, so this is what we mean by leading with the complex. Let's press forward. Okay, now, every sentence has two parts, and this is true in every language. English sentences have these two parts, Urdu sentences have these two parts, and they are the subject and the predicate. The primary portion of the sentence would be the subject, and this must be either a noun or an entity. It's the thing you talk about. Predicate is what you say about the primary portion, and this could be either in the form of another noun, so you have two nouns completing the entire sentence, like Zayd is a human, or it could be an adjective, Zayd is tall, or it could be a compound structure, like Zayd is in the house. So in the house, together, all of those words are speaking about the subject at the front of the sentence. So this is true for every language. Every sentence must have these two parts. The first is called subject, the other one is called predicate. In English, the discussion stops here. There's no further development of the subject and the predicate. Okay, because all sentences in English begin with the noun. All sentences in English begin with the noun. Regardless of what kind of predicate you have, the noun will be at the front. In the nominal sentence, like the three examples I just gave you, Zayd is a human, Zayd is tall, Zayd is in the house. Okay, that's fine. Zayd went, Zayd hit Amr. You see, now I'm using verbs, but still Zayd's at the front. So basically, subject and predicate, that's all we have. And there's no major issues to tackle over there because the sequence is determined in the grammar. And if there's no verb, then there's a is. Okay, in Arabic, there's no sequence, there's no is. So do you understand? This is the topic of today's presentation. We're going to speak about the lack of sequence determining grammar. The lack of sequence determining grammar and the lack of the is issue. So these are two major problems that need to be addressed. Okay, so the grammar people notice this. They know that these are the two issues. So I'm going to give you the solution for the lack of is issue, and I'm going to give you the solution for the sequence not determining grammar issue. Okay, so there's these two parts. Every sentence has them, subject and predicate. In Arabic, the grammarians, because of the two issues that will develop throughout this presentation, they've chose to classify the sentence into two parts, into two categories. The first is the verbal sentence, and the second is the nominal sentence. Okay, the reason why this classification is important is because in Arabic, the verb is at the front, which is a fundamental difference than how it is in English. Okay, so if you choose to speak a verb, first of all, you have a choice. You don't have to bring a verb. You can create a sentence without a verb, like those three examples I gave you a minute ago. Zayd is a human, Zayd is tall, and Zayd is in the house. So in those three examples, I used the word is, which technically is a verb, but in Arabic, if I was to speak that, there would be no is. Okay, so basically, those are verbless sentences. Okay, then I can choose to use a verb. So the minute you choose to use a verb, then the thing is that the verb has to be at the very front. Every verb must have a subject, and the subject must follow it. This is set in stone. This is the principle. And this is what dictates the classification we have on the screen right now. Had it not been for this principle, we would not have needed this classification. We could have used the generic terms, subject and predicate, everywhere as they do in English. This is going to make a lot more sense, inshallah, as we move forward with the presentation. So here's the principle. The doer of the verb must follow the verb. Okay, so if I want to say Zayd went, I'm going to bring Zahaba first, and I'm going to bring Zayd second, and Zahaba Zaydun is the standard format. Okay, this is how you would say Zayd went. In a nominal sentence, they don't have verbs. Okay, so you can have a sentence that doesn't have a verb at all. Okay, like Al-Kitabu Jadidun, the book is new. Okay? And a third kind of sentence in Arabic would be that it begins with an ism. So we have an ism at the front. Okay, and then there's a verb following. There's a verb following. So what I just told you two slides ago, in order to reconcile with that, because that principle has no exceptions, the fact that the subject of a verb needs to follow it, we're going to have to understand this differently. And this is an extremely advanced topic, but I'm confident, inshallah, you'll be able to get it. Look at the example. Okay, Zaydun Dhahaba. If I say Zaydun Dhahaba, the translation is not Zayd went, because that was the previous one. That was Dhahaba Zaydun. If I say Zaydun Dhahaba, actually what I'm saying is Zayd, comma, he went. So the total number of words there are three. There's the Zayd at the front, and then there's the Dhahaba verb. Dhahaba needs a subject, because we said on the previous slide, every verb must have a subject following it. So Dhahaba needs a subject. There's no noun following it, so what do? This is what we do. We pull out a huwa, and we would say that this verb is containing an implicit he. And verbs have that potential. Verbs have the potential to carry pronouns. Okay, a lot of the times there's something stuck to it, like a wow. Like in the istansaru example. So in that case, the wow itself would be the subject. But if there's nothing stuck to it, then by default, the verb has the capacity to contain a huwa. So the total number of words are three. Two of them are physically present, and the third one is assumed and inferred. And inference is something that we employ in our everyday lives. Majority of the knowledge we get it through inference. We don't get it through observing directly. And this is like the man that walks into the house through the door, and there's two rooms, and we don't find him in one room. What does that mean? That means he must be in the other, right? By rational necessity. So sometimes knowledge of the person being in a particular room is gained through observing him directly, and other times it's gained by finding one room empty of him, so we know he's in the other. So there's like a difference between inferred knowledge and observed knowledge. And if a person is writing in front of us producing beautiful calligraphy, so what we observe is the movement of the fingers and the formation of the letters on the paper. Okay, so that's what we're seeing. But along with that, we have further knowledge. And that is, number one, the person is alive. And number two, he's not paralyzed. And number three, he's skilled in the art of writing. And number four, he's actually willing to write. So the life and the will and the knowledge and the power, the capability, all of that is inferred. So, because meanings presuppose meanings. Okay, enough of that. That was a bit about logic. But that's okay. So what we're seeing on the screen is initially two words, but through the principle that we gave two slides ago, we know that the actual number of words are three. Okay, and that third one is understood with the arrow and the huwa. Okay, so hopefully that's fine. Now, here are the two issues, the sequence not determining grammar issue. So in verbal sentences, this is the problem, because if you have a verb and you have the two isms lined up alongside it, then you need to have some mechanism to figure out which of the nouns is the one doing the verb and which of the nouns is the one upon whom the verb is being done. So every language needs to address this. So Urdu does it with extra words. So along with the verb and the two nouns, you'll have a ne and you'll have a ko. So when you combine it together, you get Zaid ne amar ko mara. So Zaid hit amar. So now the ne is distinguishing which noun is the subject and the ko is distinguishing which noun is the object. And if you switch it around, and switch around the ne and the ko, then Zaid becomes the object and Amr becomes the subject. Zaid ko Amr ne. Now Zaid is the object and Amr is the subject. So what is ne? What is ko? These are extra words. So Urdu does it through extra words. English does it through the order. So the noun that's at the very front needs to be the subject, and then we have the verb in the middle and the object at the end. So every language has this method. The method that the Arab people have developed in order to distinguish between their grammatical meanings is the most superior meaning, is the most superior method, because number one, it does not rely on extra words, and number two, sequence remains flexible. And you're going to see this on the next slide. If you look on the next slide, we've taken the Zaid and the Amr and the verb Daraba, and we've arranged them in six different ways. And these are the six total possible ways that the three words can be arranged. And they all mean the same, they all convey the same basic meaning of Zaid hit Amr. So in all six examples, the subject is Zaid, and in all six examples, the object is Amr. So from these six, obviously one of them is standard, and that would be the one that's circled green, Zaid hit Amr. So everything else being equal, this is the one you choose. You wouldn't deviate from this one for no reason. Okay, now what are the other five? So those other five are unconventional. So it depends on the knowledge that the audience already has. So if the audience is already aware of the action having occurred, and they already know who did the action, and the only new piece of information you're giving them is the fact that Amr was the one that's hit, then you would use the one in the bottom, the yellow one, the one that's circled yellow. And the translation of that one in English would be this: it was Amr that Zaid hit. Okay, you'd have to use all those words. It was Amr that Zaid hit, because the stress needs to be on Amr. And if you bring Amr at the front in English and not use all of those words, then it becomes Amr hit Zaid and the meaning changes. Amr hit Zaid, the meaning changes, because now Amr is the subject. So sequence determines the grammar in English. But in Arabic, since we don't have sequence, and since the endings are what's doing it for us, so Zaid has a particular ending. And if you notice in all six examples, Zaid's ending is the same ending. And if you notice in all six examples, Amr's ending is the same ending. So Dhamma's on Zaid and Fatha on Amr. So this is how we know that Zaid's the subject. And it doesn't matter, all six of them convey the same basic meaning. So the translation of this one circled in yellow is, it was Amr that Zaid hit. Okay, if you probably already noticed that this is also an example that could be presented for, here we go, this is an example that could be presented for highlighting the comprehensiveness of the Arabic language at the sentence level. This is the istansaru equivalent. Okay, like over there, we do it at the word level using the istansaru example. And if you want to do it at the sentence level, then just list this example and show them that Amran daraba Zaydun. What in Arabic looks like three words is conveying actually what in English needs six words to convey. It was Amr that Zayd hit. Unless you're speaking like Yoda from Star Wars, because Yoda says Amr, Zayd hit. Okay, but then Yoda's restructuring of the sentence is meaningless because he does that everywhere. Isn't that right? Okay, so in order to achieve, so he's reduced the flexibility and he's restricted himself to one particular sequence. Okay, so which is unconventional. But at any rate, I mentioned that because there might be some smart pencils thinking about that. So that was, I just preempted that for you. Okay, let's continue with this. Let's proceed. So in verbal sentences, sequence does not determine grammar. So how do we determine it? We determine it by the endings. So Zayd has a particular ending and Amr has a particular ending. And it's by this ending we know Zayd's the doer. And it's by this ending we know that Amr's the object. Now it doesn't matter which one's first and which one's second. Okay, so the problem is sequence not determining grammar, and the solution is the grammatical states. Having these mental constructs, that's what they are, they're mental constructs. Rafa is a mental construct, and so is Nasab and so is Jar, and taking the roles that the ism can occupy within the sentence and assigning them across the three states. So subject belongs to Rafa, object belongs to Nasab, and the reflection for Rafa is Dhamma, and the reflection for Nasab is Fatta, so they look different, literally, it's like he, him, and his. Okay, so that's how the problem of sequence is solved. Okay, in nominal sentences, we have an entirely different issue. Okay, because subject and object presuppose verb, nominal sentences do not necessarily need to have a verb. Okay, so what is that problem? That is the lack of the is issue. Okay, because in English, if you have a long sentence, like let me give you an example. If you have a sentence such as, the ancient book written in 2500 BC by Sun Tzu is available in the bookstores. So all of those words prior to the is in English would be considered the subject. The is would divide and available in the bookstore would become the predicate. But if I was to render that meaning into Arabic, if I was to say that in Arabic, I would not use the verb is. So how do you determine from where to where is the subject, where to where is the predicate? So this calls for another solution. Okay, okay. So now there's a minimum and there's a maximum. So if you're dealing with only two words, then the division is pretty easy because you just drop the is in between, like the sentence on the left side, al-kitabu jadidun. That's a full sentence, and necessarily al-kitab would be the subject and jadid would be the object. So the lack of is sort of makes sense because there's no other option. It's when it becomes larger, then this becomes a real issue that needs to be addressed. Okay. In the two-word sentence, the only thing you need to do is you need to be able to distinguish it from the phrase-level relationship on the right side. Al-kitabul jadidu, that's a phrase, that means the new book. Notice that the words used in the sentence example and in the phrase example are identical, same words. And also notice that the sequence is the same, that the noun is at the front, adjective second, in both examples. Okay, so how do you distinguish that? You'd have to know what characterizes the descriptive phrase. So part of that is that the two need to correspond and they have to have the same value in terms of being definite or indefinite. So if one of them is definite, the other one also needs to be definite. And we're seeing that in the Al-Kitabul Jadidu example, but we're not seeing that in the Al-Kitabu Jadidun example. Okay, so this is a topic. Like from the phrases, what we do normally in our 3 weeks is that we develop two of them. Okay, and there's like a dozen plus ways that words can connect together in phrase level relationships. Okay, so let's speak a little about phrases right here because I'm not going to exhaust the topic. I would normally devote 25 minutes to the possessive phrase and 25 minutes to the descriptive one. And that would give you all you need to know as part of the 4% of the language that gives you the broadest application. And then the rest of the phrases are covered gradually over the course of 7 to 9 weeks. And there's 12 of them. So if you know all 12 of them, then you'd be able to resolve the lack of is issue, and I'll tell you that in a minute. Okay, so here are the two phrases we have on the screen. The one at the top is Kitabu Zaydin, the translation is Zayd's book, that's the possessive phrase. The other one underneath that, tall boy, that's an example of a descriptive phrase, and the new book was also an example on the previous slide, Al-Kitabul Jadidu, the new book, that's a descriptive phrase, and so is tall boy. If you look at them and compare them, you'll notice that the states of the two words in the possessive are not matching. that the first word has a different ending, and the second word Zayd has a different ending. So I can't give you all of the regulations that govern this type of structure, but I can tell you this, that the second half of the possessive phrase is fixed on jar. So it has a particular grammatical state, which is jar. So as we move forward, giving you 15 of the 22 places, we're going to bring this back, and we're going to say second half of the possessive structure has a particular name, which is mudaf ilayh. Okay, unfortunately, I can't develop it for you here, because we're short on time, so I'm going to have to press forward. So mudaf ilayh, just remember that, mudaf and mudaf ilayh. And even if you forget, don't worry, I'm going to remind you again, as we get to the development of the 22 places. In the second, in the one underneath that, the descriptive, the two parts of that, the first one is the one being described, and the second word is the adjective. So that sequence is important. It's opposite of what it would be, it's opposite of how it would be done in English. You would say tall boy, but in Arabic you would say waladun tawilun, with the boy word first and the tall word second. Again, much more could be said about these two types of phrases, but we're going to need to press forward. Okay, now in nominal sentences, the issue is the lack of is issue, and this issue becomes more profound the bigger the sentence becomes. Like that Sun Tzu example I gave you, that the ancient book written by Sun Tzu in 2500 BC is available in the bookstores. So if there's no is, how are you going to determine that? Okay. The answer to this question, the solution to the lack of is issue, is you would have to know the 12 plus phrase level relationships, and you'd have to move from right to left and exhaust them. So wherever all of the phrases end, that's where the predicate begins. So how would you know from where to where is the subject and where to where is the predicate? It would be by knowing where the phrase level relationships end. That's where you drop the is. Okay, what that means is that the first word and the second word would need to be compared, and you'd have to see if there's correspondence, and you'd have to see if the regulations that apply to the various types of phrases apply. If they do, then that means your predicate hasn't started yet. You'd have to move forward. You look at the third word and try to connect that one with the previous two, so what you have is a larger phrase. And you look at the next one, and then if you see a clause developing, then that means still your predicate hasn't begun. Okay, like written in 2500 BC, so that means that the predicate has not yet started. In Arabic, we just keep moving from right to left, and where all of the extensions exhaust, and where all of the phrases end, that's where the predicate begins. So this is the extent that I'm going to talk about in this presentation about the lack of is issue. Okay, because the entire total solution of it depends on knowing the 12 types of phrases, and since in the introductory theory we don't give you all 12 of them, that's why the proper solution for it is it takes about 7 to 9 weeks in order to be fully comfortable with this. In other words, to not have any trouble with this problem and just to be able to solve it effortlessly. So that's done through the reading text. Okay. Now the components of the sentence. So now the grammar people, they recognize that we have fundamentally two kinds of sentences that in English do not exist, because in English the noun is at the very front all the time. But since in Arabic there's a possibility of the verb being at the front, okay, so if one chooses to speak a verb, then that's what will happen. Okay, if there's no verb at all, then the noun will be at the front. Okay, now since the issue in the verbal sentence is of an entirely different kind than the issue that's in the nominal sentence, what the grammar people chose to do is, number one, they chose to classify the sentence into two categories, and number two, they chose to take the generic terms, subject and predicate, and come up with four more specific terms. Depending on what kind of sentence you're dealing with, the subject and the predicate will have different names. So when they appear in the nominal sentence, they're called Mubtada and Khabar. So in the example, the book is new, the word book would be labeled Mubtada, and the word new would be labeled Khabar. In a verbal sentence, first of all, you need to know that the verb's at the front, so that's an example of the predicate preceding the subject, which in English does not happen. Okay, but in Arabic it would happen. Zahaba Zaydun, Zahab is the predicate, and Zayd is the subject, but we're not going to say subject and predicate, we're going to say Fi'al and Fa'il. Fi'al literally means verb, and Fa'il means doer of the verb. Okay, so like conceptually we understand that this is subject predicate, but when we address and when we speak and when we analyze and when we parse, we discard the more generic terms musnad ilay and musnad. Musnad ilay means subject and musnad means predicate, but instead we opt for the more specific term. The reason is because when you're speaking about one issue and when you're trying to resolve that issue, the terms you use within that discussion should be specific to it and should not conflict with the terms that you would use in the other discussion, tackling the other issue, providing the different solution. So since the issues are separate and since the solutions of each are different, terminology should also be specific. And this is something you will hear nowhere else, the way I explained it here. So let's continue with this again. Let's move forward. Okay, so we're not going to speak about the lack of is issue. We're going to continue with the grammatical states. So in the previous presentation, I gave you the house example. And I showed you how Rafa means subject. Rafa is an example of, or he, him, and his. Rafa means he, Nasab means him, and Jar means his. Okay, so I'm going to bring that slide back for you, inshallah, right now. So if you look at that slide, you'll notice that the word house is being used in three different ways. In English, if a pronoun is used in three different ways, we see a difference. We see, like, he came, I saw him, his pen. Okay, he came, I saw him, his pen. But in the house, in the case of the house, in the three sentences, if you look at the translation column, you'll notice that the word house is not changing. The house fell down. I entered the house, door of the house. House, house, house. But in Arabic, when we express these meanings in Arabic, the word al-bayt would actually change based on the way it's being used. So when the house is intended to be subject of the verb, you say saqat al-baytu. And when the house is intended to be object of the verb, you say dakhaltu al-bayta. And when the house is the second half of a possessive phrase, you say babul bayti. Okay, so this slide and the introduction of the topic in the previous presentation gave the impression that Rafa meant subject, Nasab meant object, and Jar meant possessive. So it's just another way of saying subject, object, possessive, Rafa, Nasab, Jar. Now, in our second developing of the topic, what we're going to do is we're going to build on that understanding and we're going to correct some of the misconception there. So it was like, we fuzzied it because if we were to aim for accuracy in the first introduction, it would have overwhelmed the beginner. And it would have failed to create the mental imprint, which was the aim and the goal back there. Okay, so now, subject, object, possessive. Rafa cannot mean subject. Nasab cannot mean object, and Jar cannot mean possessive. The reason is because, if you're with us until now, you've already figured out that the total possible usages for the ism are more than just three. If you say Rafa means subject, Nasab means object, Jar means possessive, then you restricted it to three. And clearly that can't be true. The reason is because we have an entire other category of sentence that doesn't even have subject and object. Because both subject and object, and by the way, when I say subject, I mean doer. I don't mean musnad ilay. I don't mean subject as opposed to predicate, but I mean subject as opposed to object. Both of those presuppose verb, but since we have sentences that don't even have verbs, so you wouldn't have a subject and an object in that sentence. You would instead have a fourth and a fifth. A further possible usage for the ism. So you see then, so we've already invalidated that restriction and we've removed that misconception, and now it's a matter of knowing what's the total. Okay, so subject, object, possessive is not all there is, there's more. Okay, so the earlier three were subject, doer of a verb, object, and possessive. So those were the three that were listed on the previous slide. Saqat al-baytu, that's an example of subject. Dakhaltu al-bayta, I entered the house, that's an example of object. And babul bayti, door of the house, is an example of possessive. Other than that, in a nominal sentence, we have the subject of the nominal, which has a different name, is called mubtada. And we have the predicate of the nominal sentence, which again has a different name, that's called khabar. So added on to the previous three, so now we have five. And in Arabic, the subject of a verb is called fa'il. The object of a verb is called maf'ul bihi, and these terms will come in the upcoming slides, and the transcript will inshallah write out for you the actual Arabic terms. And normally what I do in the class is at the end of the introductory theory, I give them a cheat sheet. Okay, and what I mean by a cheat sheet is like a one-page document with all of the terms listed on them, all of the vocabulary, all of the grammar vocabulary. So you have the Arabic term, English equivalent, Arabic term, English equivalent, Arabic term, English equivalent. So you can just print it out and sort of just glance at it, and then it will remind you of all of the mini presentations that you will have spent considerable time developing, because that's what we do. That's the behavior that we want. In the startup phase, we want the students to listen to this again and again, and we want them to develop mini presentations. Okay, so fa'il, maf'ul bihi, maful bihi, and the term is coming, so don't worry about it. And I need to do this. There's no other way I'm going to get through this in 1 hour. Okay, so just bear with us. Possessive, the term for that is mudaf ilay. And the other option was to not do it. Okay, the other option was to just give fluff and give filler and just sort of entertain. Okay, but you see, if I do that, I lose your attention because I haven't given you any value. And my whole point behind this free series of videos is, even if you don't choose to join the program, then I still want you to feel that your time was spent well. Okay, and then if you continue your self-study, you will at least be moving much more quicker than you are now. You see? Okay. So subject of a nominal sentence is called muftada, and the predicate of a nominal sentence is called khabar. And coming after a preposition will be a further usage, and we call that majroor. Just simply majroor, coming after a preposition, and these terms will be listed in the upcoming slides. Okay, so now we're already like much more than we started with. We started off with three, and now we have six. And then there's numerous types of adverbs, and again, this will be developed further. And the total, so now the question is, what's the total? Okay, so we've invalidated three, so what's the total? The new total now is 22. Okay, so number one, why are there so many? So let's get some idea. What are the factors that contributed to this number being so large? So it's the broadness of the ism itself, because the ism is not only nouns, but the ism includes nouns, it includes pronouns, it includes adjectives, and it includes adverbs. And from these four, the way an adverb would be used in a sentence is radically different than the way a noun would be used. Okay, like in a verbal sentence, for example, the subject of a verb must be an entity, like we mentioned earlier. So you can't take the word quickly and consider it the subject of a verb. That doesn't work, because quickly, the kind of word sort of determines its usage. Like, and the word them would be an object, and the word very, for example, would be an adjective. You see, since the ism is so broad, that contributes to the number being so large. Hopefully that's pretty clear. And let's continue with this. And another reason why we have so many usages is because the grammarians have classified the sentence into two categories, and they've chosen to come up with different terminology. So the minute our terminology increases, our number of usages increases. Okay, so they're labeled differently. So this also contributes to the number being very large. So we still don't know why it's 22, but we have some idea of why the number is large. You see, remember the onions and the peeling the layers of the onions. Okay, now, some of these 22 are nominal sentence specific. In other words, they will be found only in the nominal sentence. And like the two halves of the muftada, the two halves of the nominal sentence, they could be considered two usages for the ism. The ism can occur as a muftada. The ism can occur as a khabar. Okay, so it's playing a role. You have an ism that's occupying the slot of the muftada, and you have another ism that's occupying the slot of the khabar. Okay, there's certain governing agents that can come at the beginning of a nominal sentence, and it would influence the endings. It would induce change. So what was previously muftada would no longer be muftada. It would be called something else. And what was previously khabar would no longer be khabar. It would be called something else. And I'm going to have to leave this as a cliffhanger. I'm going to come back to this at the end of the presentation. Okay, so this is what happens. This is why the number is large in consideration of the nominal sentence. So we start off with the earlier two of muftada and khabar, and then the number further, it results in the aggregators, the governing agents that can come at the front of the nominal sentence will create further usages. And again, we're going to come back to this towards the end of the presentation. In verbal sentences, first of all, we have a who. Every verbal sentence needs to have a subject, and that would be a usage for the ism, right? It would be an ism that occupies that usage. And then many verbs would also have an object. And then there's numerous other details beyond the subject and the object, and that's all based on relevance. It's based on how much detail the speaker chooses to convey. Okay, so he might want to answer the question when, or he might want to provide an answer to the question where, or to the question why, or to the question how, or he might want to modify the action aspect of the verb, like quickly and swiftly. Okay, he might want to bring a prepositional phrase, which is also a detail of the verb. Because in the case of an action such as a movement, you not only will you have a doer, you will have a destination and an origin. So whatever words you use to express the destination will be a further detail of the verb, and it will be an ism that's part of that phrase, like Basra and Kufa. So this creates a larger number. So these are possible ways an ism could be used that are specific to the verbal sentence. First of all, the first one is the subject, and that's called fa'il, and the second one is the object. And other than that, the verb could also be passive. What happens in a passive verb is the subject disappears. And in English, it would be like, the apple, Zayd ate an apple, and that would be reformatted to the apple was eaten. So now, in this sentence, the usage of the apple is different than it was in the previous one. Okay, so this could be considered an additional usage. And right now, we're just trying to understand the large number, and then we're going to come back and we're going to tie them all together and assign them to the three states that we have already. So we're not discarding the three states. The states are the same states, Rafa, Nasab, and Jar. But the whole point behind this is to correct the inaccuracy. In the previous development of the topic, we gave the impression that Rafa meant subject, Nasab meant object, and Jar meant possessive. Now we're saying that Rafa is a broad category, and subject is an example of Rafa, and there's more. Nasab is a broad category, object is an example of Nasab, and there's more. And similarly, Jar is a broad category, and Mudaf Ilay, in other words, second half of the possessive structure, is one example of Jar, and there's more. So how are these 22 assigned? So we're going to talk about that as we move forward with the presentation. So regarding the example that's on the screen, Zayd ate an apple, the apple was eaten. So in the case of an apple, on the left side, that word tufahan is object. And in the case of the passive verb, the object occupies the place of the subject goes missing, the name changes, we call it deputy doer. So deputy doer, you can add that to the list. Okay. And then there's different kinds of adverbs, because we have a generic adverb, which is just modifying the action or explaining the degree, the intensity, or like slowly and quickly, or very, or the word extremely. Kathiran means extremely or abundantly, or even very. Farihtu kathiran, I became very happy. So we have our fi'l, which is the farih part, and then the subject is the tu, and then kathiran would be the adverb. So that's what we call a generic adverb. There's no time connotation to it. It's not answering the question where, it's not answering the question when, but it's modifying the action aspect of the verb. And then the when, where one, that has a special name. The when, where one, and that will be given to you on the upcoming slide. And the example is, today Zayd hit Amr. Today Zayd hit Amr. So the word today is modifying the time aspect of Daraba. Kathina was modifying the action aspect of Daraba. And al-yawm is modifying the time aspect. So that's a kind of adverb. And then we have the reason and cause adverb. So darabtuhu means I hit him. Ta'diban means for the purpose of discipline. So in Arabic we're able to do that in a single word. In English you can't do that. You have to say for discipline. You have to bring the word for. So this is the adverb that in English should have existed but doesn't. The adverb of reason and cause. And then our last one is the circumstantial one. So you're answering the question how. Zayd came to me. How did he come? He came riding. So the word riding is an ism. You see, so it's an ism that's occupying the generic adverb. So kathiran is an ism, al-yawm is an ism, ta'diban is an ism, and rakiban is also an ism. And we're speaking about the total possible ways an ism could be used. So we're getting some idea. And it's not random either. I'm not just giving you a random listing. I spoke about the nominal sentence specific ones at the beginning. And now I'm speaking about the usages that are specific to the verbal sentence. And since prepositional phrases are also considered details of the verb, the ism that follows the preposition could be considered a further usage. So if you count the number that we're at about 11 at this stage right now. Okay, let me recap them without the slides. So the two parts of the nominal, that's muftada and khabar. And then we have the who, in the case of the verbal sentence, that's called fa'il. And then we have the object of the verbal. And then after the object of the verbal would be the deputy doer, which is specific to the passive verb, the apple was eaten, so that's five. And then these four types of adverbs that we just gave you right now, the four types of adverbs, the generic one, the when, where one, the why one, and the how one, so that's nine. An object of preposition would be the tenth, and the second half of the possessive would be the eleventh, like babul bayti, door of the house. So how do we distinguish between the different usages of the ism? Okay, so before jumping to the process, okay, so you know the endings? Okay, before that, many times what happens is the kind of word sort of gives it away, the type of word. Okay, let me tell you exactly what I mean by this, and you might want to listen to this portion a couple of times. If I have a verb and multiple isms, you see, so I've changed the term. I'm not saying multiple nouns, I'm saying multiple isms. And from amongst those isms, two of them are what the English people call noun. And then the other ones are what the English people call adverb. Right? So I have a lengthy sentence, and here's an example. I'm just making up this example. Okay, it might not be the most appropriate example, but I need to give you an example. So I hit Zaid viciously, okay, in front of the masjid yesterday. Okay, in front of the masjid yesterday. So I have viciously in there. So there's the I, and then there's the Zaid. So I is an ism, Zaid is an ism, the word yesterday is an ism, viciously is an ism, in front of the masjid. So the word in front, the word in Arabic that I would use for the word in front would be amam. And that's an adverb, that's an ism. And the word masjid is also an ism. So all of those isms. So from those isms, the I is attached to the verb, okay, in the sense that it's ending. It's darabtu. Zaydan. Okay. So now or if you say Zayd hit Amr in front of the masjid viciously, leave everything the same, just take away the I and make it Zayd and Amr. From all of these, it's only the Zayd and the Amr that need to be distinguished. The rest are distinguished by the kind of word it is. So when I say al-yawm, that's automatically going to be the adverb of time, the answer to the question when. So now Amr and the word today having the same ending is fine. But Zayd and Amr having the same ending is problematic, because there we won't know, because they're both candidates, they're both capable of becoming subject and also becoming object. So they need to be distinguished. The rest of them don't need to be distinguished, because the kind of word sort of distinguishes it for you. And hopefully that makes sense, right? And if I stick in the word viciously, now that word viciously is not going to be the subject. It's the kind of word determines that it's going to be an adverb. So it can have the same ending as Amr has. And yet there will be no confusion, because Amr is, by virtue of being the entity, Amr is the object, and by virtue of being an attribute, the word viciously would need to be a further detail and not the object detail. Okay, so hopefully that was fine. And then from these 22 possible ways an ism could be used, many of them are found only in the nominal sentence and not found in the verbal, and the ones in the verbal are not found in the nominal. So what this again, it allows us to recycle the endings. So now the ending that we give to the fa'il, which is dhamma, we can give that to the muqtada and it's not problematic, because fa'il and muqtada will not be found together. So there's no distinguishing to do between them. So it allows the recycling of the endings. So where there is genuine confusion, where there is possibility of genuine confusion, like the two nouns following the verb, in which case we need to know which of the nouns is the one doing the verb and which of the nouns is the one upon whom the verb is being done, this is where the process, the mechanism, and the grammatical states come in play, and they do the distinguishing for us. So some of it's distinguished by the kind of word, and some of it's distinguished by the kind of sentence that it falls in or it's found in. And then when you have multiple isms occurring in the same type of sentences that are candidates for being both subject and object, at that point you need the structure. So most of what I'm talking about is specific to the verbal sentence. So this is the solution to the problem that occurs in the verbal sentence, the lack of sequence determining grammar issue. Okay? Yeah, so the total amount of ways an ism could be used is 22. So although the total amount of ways an ism could be used is 22, the amount of grammatical states and endings we need is not 22. We don't need 22 different endings. Why? Because the kind of word sometimes narrows it down for us already. Okay, and then the type of sentence that it's found in narrows it down. So many of them are not found alongside each other. So we can recycle the endings, so we don't need a large number like 22. We don't need 22 different states, and we don't need 22 different endings. What we need is the bare minimum amount of endings that will resolve for us all confusion, and that number happens to be 3. Okay, so what we need to know now is how the 22 distribute into the 3, and this would end the discussion. So let's relist for you the 3 states and show you the distribution. So Rafa is a broad category that accounts for 8 possible usages of the ism. Nasab is an even broader category that accounts for 12 of the possible usages. And Jar is the smallest of the 3, and that has 2 contained within it. So subject is in Rafa. Alongside subject there's 7 more. Object is in Nasab, and alongside object is 11 more. And مضاف إليه, the second half of the possessive structure is in jar, like the door of the house example. And along with that, there's one more. So since jar is the smaller of the three categories, let's proceed with that. Let's begin with jar. So on the screen, you see the two places of jar, and there's no third place. The only other place in the language, besides second half of possessive, where a word would be considered in the state of jar and have a kasra on the last letter, as a result of which have a kasra on the last letter, is coming after a preposition, and the example is there, fil bayti, in the house. In the house. And the prepositions are numbered, we know what they are. Fi is one of them, min is one of them, ala is one of them, lam is one of them. Any ism that follows a preposition will be in the state of jar, and jar does not happen anywhere else. Okay, as for rafa, the two halves of the nominal sentence are both in rafa. So the subject of the nominal sentence is called mubtada, and that's in rafa. The predicate of the nominal sentence is also in rafa. And for those two to have the same ending is not problematic, because the problem there is not one of sequence anyways. It's one of lack of is, and the solution is to know the phrase level relationship. So having the same ending does not trouble us. It does not create any confusion. And remember, the whole point behind grammar is to remove confusion, and this is why it's so important. And in a verbal sentence, the doer, the subject of a verb, that's also in rafa, so it has a dhamma, like we saw in the zaydun, in the zayd hit amr example. Zaydun in all six of those was with dhamma, so fa'il is clearly belongs to rafa. And in the passive structure, the apple was eaten, ukilat tufahu. Ukila means was eaten, as opposed to akala. Akala means ate, and ukila means was eaten. Ukila tufahu. So that's also, it also belongs to rafa. So we have four currently in the rafa, and now we're filling the slots, and we're going to get as close to 22 as we can. So now moving into the places of nasab, we have the first one, which is the object of the verb. In Arabic, that's called maful bihi. Okay, and that would be amr in the example, zayd hit amr. ضرب زيد عمرا. Okay, generic adverb is called مفعول مطلق. مطلق means unconditional, and it doesn't have any time aspect to it, so it's not the answer to the question when or where or why or how, but yet it's modifying the verb in some way. So that's called generic adverb. The example is كثيرا. In the example, فرحت كثيرا, I became extremely happy. So the word extremely is what we would call a مفعول مطلق. And if it's answering the question when or where, then that's called maful fi, and it could be time, like today zayd hit amr, or in front of the masjid, or before, or after, or above, or beneath. Any of these words would be considered maful fi, because they all indicate on time or place. Okay, the reason in cause one, the example of that is, I hit him for the purpose of discipline, ضربته تأديبا, and that's called maful lahu. The circumstantial one is this hal, and the example for that is جاءني زيدون راكباً, and راكباً means riding. Zayd came to me riding. Okay, so we have five added to the previous four. Our number is now nine, and added to, and including the previous two, the jar ones, we're at 11. We're at 11, and most of these are related to the verbal sentence. All five of the ones that you see on the screen right now occur in verbal sentences. Fa'il, naif fa'il also occurs in verbal sentences. Mubtada and khabar don't. Mubtada and khabar are the two halves of the nominal sentence. What else can happen in a nominal sentence? Here we go. At the beginning of the nominal sentence, you can have a certain governing agent that would abrogate the sentence. What was previously mubtada is no longer mubtada. The name changes. Okay, and this is kana. Kana is an auxiliary verb, and it means was. So first of all, when you add kana to the beginning of the book is new, the translation would change to the book was new. Okay, the book, the translation would change. Okay, not only that, but what was previously called mubtada is no longer mubtada, because now it has a verb before it. Okay, but since it's a special kind of verb, we're going to invent new terminology to talk about it. So we're going to say, so first of all, we start off with the mubtada and the khabar. Okay, now with the introduction of kana, the sentence changes. It becomes kana al-kitabu jadidan. Pause for a minute and look at the ending of the word al-kitab, and look at the ending of the word jadid. Previously, both of them were in rafa. Now one of them is in rafa, and the other one's in nasab. So you see, so now we have five in rafa, and one more in nasab, and we're gonna come back to that again, and I'll bring back the chart so we can see them all happening on a single screen. Okay, so the two halves. So the name changes. It's called ism of kana, and previously what was called khabar is now called the khabar of kana. And what that means is the subject of the kana sentence and the predicate of the kana sentence, and that's pretty much it. Other than that, we have inna, which is another governing agent. And it can come at the beginning of the nominal sentence. It will abrogate the sentence. And what that means is that what previously was mubtada is no longer mubtada, and what was previously khabar is no longer khabar. But then it's called the ism of inna, and the khabar is called the khabar of inna. And obviously the meaning changes because inna means indeed. So we have a new meaning, and not only do we have new meaning, but we have new usages for the ism. So our number is getting even larger. So we're at 11. So if you take the 2 from the kana and the 2 from the inna, we're at 15. Okay, so here you go. Here's all 15 of them. Okay, mubtada means the subject of the nominal. Khabar means the predicate of the nominal. Fa'il means the doer of the verb. Okay, which has to follow it. Naif fa'il means the deputy doer, or you can say the subject of the passive verb. Ism of kana is the first portion of the kana structure, the book example in the book, in the example, kan al-kitabu jadidan. And khabar of inna is the second half of the inna structure. So if you take the two that resulted from kana and the two that resulted from inna, you would take the first of the kana and the second of the inna, place them in rafa. You would take the second of the kana and the first of the inna and place them in nasab. So in nasab we have quite a few. We have seven in nasab now. Maful bihi being the first one, object of a verb. Maful mutlaq, generic adverb, like very and swiftly and quickly and extremely. And then maful fi is the answer to the question when and where. Okay, maful lahu is the reason and cause one, like for the purpose of discipline. Hal is the Zayd came to me riding, circumstantial adverb. Okay, and then again, the second half of the kana structure, the first half of the inna structure. And jar category is closed. And the two that occupy the jar category, number one, second half of a possessive structure, mudaf ilayh, and number two, any ism that follows a preposition, and that's simply called majroor. And this concludes what we would do in the introductory theory. At this stage, we would begin the book. And here, I've created a scan for you from the Stories of the Prophets book, the Qasasun Nabiyyin book. And if I had time, I would give you another half an hour and speak about the structures here, and I would bring all of that theory to life. So every word here, so if you, in these four or five lines, you would see at least 20 examples. And all of the theory that you just learned would solidify every time you saw it. So this is like the first four lines. Okay, but at this stage, I'm not able to do that. I'm going to have to stop here. And I really, really enjoyed creating this free series of videos for you. I hope you enjoyed them. And I hope you got a good amount of value from what we shared with you in these last 10 days. I certainly enjoyed creating the videos for you. And I'll see you again. Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.